Good morning and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us, listening on WILL. And if you're watching on our website, we're webcasting this hour of the show on WILL.illinois.edu. Our producer is Harriet Williamson. Jason Croft is at the controls for this hour, and Kyle Mabry was on for hour number one. In this part of the program, we'll be talking about the conditions, fiscal and otherwise, of the state of Illinois. Yesterday in Springfield, Governor Pat Quinn presented his budget for the fiscal year that begins on July 1st. And he told the lawmakers that the budget that he was giving them contained truths that they might not want to hear, but he said there are truths that they do need to know. He was critical of past administrations and past legislatures as they spent too much over the past 35 years, he said. And he said, today, our rendezvous with reality has arrived. The governor proposed a number of things, including a 9% across-the-board cut in spending for almost all areas of government. He talked about closing a number of prisons, mental health facilities, facilities for the developmentally disabled. He talked about consolidating a number of government field offices. But the two biggest things that everyone in Springfield knows have to be dealt with, that is Medicaid and pensions, the government Governor had no specific recommendations for. There are things that lawmakers are talking about, and we're expecting to hear more about that later this spring. So what we want to do here on the program this morning is get some reaction to what the governor had to say and talk about some of these big issues. And we're happy to have here in the studio with us two guests. Both of them have been on the program a number of times before, Fred Gertz and Bob Rich. Fred Gertz is professor of economics and is also affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs here at the University of Illinois. Robert Rich is the director of the Institute. He also has joint appointments in the colleges of law, medicine, and in the Department of Political Science. And we're pleased that they could be here. Questions are welcome, as always, 333-9455 here for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. And email is welcome, too. If you want to send us an email, send your question that way. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, questions are welcome. Well, thank you both very much for being here. We really appreciate it. Just as a way of starting, and maybe I'll start with Fresh Rich, you want to just talk a little bit about where we are now in the state of Illinois, fiscally and I suppose also politically.
Well, the state of Illinois is fiscally in terrible shape. Mm-hmm. We continue to have a huge structural deficit problem, meaning that we have less revenue than we have recurring expenses, despite the fact that we had a major tax increase, both a personal income tax increase and corporate tax increase a year ago. We still have a major revenue problem. In part, the state still has $6.5 billion of unpaid bills. From a pension perspective, we have the greatest unpaid pension liability of any state in the nation. We're 50 out of 50. And Medicaid is about 1 year overdue in paying most of its bills. So one of the sad parts of the governor's budget address, as far as I'm concerned, is that he didn't address the unpaid bill issue at all, and really didn't address where we are with respect to that. I mean, it's a good thing that he recognizes that pensions and Medicaid are major issues. It's a good thing he recognizes that cuts need to be made. But as you said, no specifics, and the heart of the recurring issue really wasn't addressed.
Yeah. You can comment in any way that you want. At some point, I do want to talk a little bit about the impact of the tax increase, but you can pick up on any of those points.
Well, let me say something kind of unusual, which is slightly positive, that this year is actually better than past years, that the state has shown a little bit of discipline in regard to the budget. We actually set a target for spending this year. The target was set at a relatively low level compared to what's done in the past, and the states live within those constraints this year. But that's only a halting step towards long-term fiscal solvency, as Bob was talking about. There are all kinds of other issues that are yet to be addressed. The other thing, which is a little bit troubling, is that almost all of the budget discipline this last year came from the General Assembly and from the House in particular. Both the governor and the Senate wanted to spend more and more and more, and again, uncharacteristically for I think the House, they actually did come down on a leaner budget. So in this one particular year, we've done all right with the extra revenue and so on. But as Bob has noted, we have this overhang of unpaid bills that still have yet to be addressed, and we have a lot of serious issues looming in the future, including the two things the governor talked about, Medicaid and pensions. Now, the problem with the governor's address is that it really wasn't a budget address. I can characterize it as someplace between a state of the state address and a budget address, because a budget is supposed to actually deliver a budget, and there was no delivery made at that point. Mm-hmm. So a couple of weeks ago, when the governor gave his state of the state address, people criticized him for being unduly optimistic and positive and so on. This time he had a much more somber tone, but yet he didn't really come up with the details. So again, the things he talked about, closing some facilities, those are serious issues and things of that sort, but he left unsaid the multi-billion dollar issue about how do you save money for Medicaid, how do you manage pensions going forward. So you have a budget where almost all the hard work is left to a kind of ill-defined committee or commission who's going to come back to him within 6 weeks and give him the real details mm-hmm. there. So it's not a very encouraging sign about solving these problems.
I was just interested in also having you talk a little bit about the impact of the tax hike, which this was approved in a little over a year ago, January 2011. Right. And it increased the personal rate for individuals from 3% to 5%, the corporate rate from 4.8% to 7%, and that's going to stay that way until 2014.
Right.
And then it's slowly going to go back to, right, unless the legislature says different, it'll slowly go back to, right, to what it was. How has the additional revenue generated really made much difference, particularly when you consider just how big the budget problems we have are?
Well, I think it made a huge difference because we were running an annual deficit of $4 or $5 billion. That is, every year we're spending maybe 20% of the budget more than we took in. So we were spending $1.20 for every dollar. The tax increase brought us more or less into temporary equilibrium as far as the current year is concerned. But as Bob mentioned, it hasn't solved our old problems, the overhang of debt. It hadn't solved the future problems in terms of these new expenditures we have to face. So the tax increase did do a lot. I'm often asked, what about the impact on the economy? And there are a lot of people saying the tax increase is really damaging to the economy. And in a normal world, that could very well be the case. If you had a well-run state that was paying its bills and taking care of its business and having a infrastructure that was helping business and education and so on, it would be crazy to have a 66 2/3% tax increase, but that's not Illinois. We were talking about a state that was on the brink of insolvency, so you have a very unpleasant choice: insolvency versus the tax increase. And my view is that the tax increase probably was a lesser of the evils. The other thing is that Illinois' voters did not put in place a new operation in the 2010 election. They reelected the governor. They reelected a Democratic House, a Democratic Senate. So it was not very likely that they were going to have a huge change in their operation. So I think the tax increase was kind of a necessary evil. And despite what I think the Republican leaders of the House and Senate said, let's repeal the tax increase, which, again, sounds nice, but the question is, what are you going to do with those $5 billion that you're spending now? And I don't see any way to do that except to have the tax increase and very likely keep it permanently.
I'm going to say, from a political perspective, which you asked about earlier, I think it is fantasy to believe that we're going to let the tax increase expire. The truth is that if we were to let it expire, the $6.5 billion problem I talked about before would increase to $13 billion by the year 2020. So I think from a political perspective, there's no way that we can let the tax increase expire. And I also think that we continue to have a major leadership problem in this state. And I would say that budget address is a good example of the leadership problem that we have in the state, because we took the two most important problems. The governor took the two most important problems and essentially said, I have no specifics here. Everybody needs to feel the pain. Everybody needs to there needs to be fairness. Now you guys go figure out how to make that happen. Yeah. I don't consider that to be true leadership.
Yeah. And the governor has actually almost become a subject of derision. I occasionally listen to Chicago talk radio, and they make fun of him about his weakness and his inability to stand up to the Speaker of the House. So this hasn't really done much to change that.
Our guests, let me just introduce again the guests for this hour of focus, Fred Gertz and Bob Rich. Fred's an economist. Bob is a professor of political science, both of them affiliated with the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Rich is the director of the Institute. And we have talked with them before about, actually, I think about all of these things we've talked about before, but we definitely wanted to have him in here to talk a little bit about what Governor Quinn said yesterday in his budget address in Springfield and how we're going to try to get a handle on some of the really big problems confronting us. Maybe I also mention just real quick that if you're interested in Illinois policy issues, you might take a look at the brand new issue of the Illinois Report. This is something that the Institute has been putting out for a number of years. This is the new issue for 2012. It's just out. You can read it on their website, or you can get a print copy if you like. And it takes a look at a number of subjects, including budget and fiscal issues, and it makes interesting reading. So this is something that you might want to take a look at. And questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Medicaid. Here is one of the two big things. The governor said that the state needs to cut $2.7 billion from the Medicaid budget. And I think that everybody knows we have an enormous problem here and it needs to be dealt with. And they say that really you got three choices. You can do three things or some of those three things. You can reduce your reimbursements to healthcare providers.
Even further.
You can rewrite the rules so that fewer people are eligible, or you can look at the services that you provide, and the state of Illinois does provide some things that are not, that the federal government does not require the state to provide. So you can say, well, some of those things like in-home care and hospice and drug coverage and so forth and dental care, maybe we'll just say, we're not going to do that anymore. How do you approach this problem when you're looking at having to cut such an enormous amount of money?
Right. Well, the one additional option is what we've been doing is not to pay the bills.
Well, okay, yes. And which, of course, places an enormous hardship on the providers who are providing the services, who have to wait for, you know, who knows how long before they get reimbursed.
The governor pointed out himself that we're the only state in the nation that intentionally doesn't pay providers on a timely basis. Yeah. But just to add one dimension, David, to what you said, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act adds complexity to the Medicaid problem. And the complexity it adds to the Medicaid problem is the act specifies that states may not cut back on eligibility or on services under a provision that's called maintenance of effort. So whatever your effort was in the year 2014 when the new Medicaid provisions come in, you can't cut back on. And that makes the Medicaid problem even more difficult. Not to mention, the act also requires that all people at 133% of the federal poverty level and below now be covered by Medicaid as well. So that adds to the dimension here. But to answer your question directly, there are some things we can do. We can mandate managed care and mandate integrated managed care, which the current director of Medicaid program wants to do. That would save money. We can cut back on some of the services, which undoubtedly needs to be done as well. The question that I have is, do we really have the political will to make those cuts combined with the problem of the federal legislation.
Yeah, and it seems that certainly one thing that has last year, I do believe, that the governor, he proposed cutting back reimbursements, and the General Assembly said, no, we're not going to do that. So now he's not, he may be talking about that again, but that seems like that certainly is a non-starter.
Right. The problem is that once you give something out, it's much more difficult to take it back than it was originally. So the fact that you extend the services beyond the legally, the federally required minimums seemed like a generous thing in the past. And Governor Blagojevich had a method of operation that was promising things and doing things that were not backed up by the money. So in addition to his ethical problems, he also had some real managerial problems as well. So these things have become ingrained. People expect him. It's very difficult to cut. And realistically, I think that there's no way that we can realize the $2.5 billion in cuts immediately. It would be devastating to go instantaneously to some kind of new system. You'd have to have a transition. So what the governor proposed is to have a committee or commission think about it for a while, come back in a couple months, and then the General Assembly presumably will take weeks or a couple months at least to deliberate. And if all goes well, the new budget would come into play in July 1st of this year for fiscal 2013. But you couldn't immediately cut off all those providers, change all the services. So the cuts here, if they actually come about, are going to be probably a year or two away, or at least it will take a year or two to fully realize them.
That doesn't sound particularly promising, it sounds as if things are likely to continue to get worse before they start getting better.
I think that the constraints on the Medicaid program are almost crippling. and we have very few degrees of freedom. And it's in those degrees of freedom where the action is going to have to take place. And that is some on eligibility for the discretionary services. And as Fred said, hard to take away, but I think if we're going to make progress, we're going to have to take those away. The reimbursement rate is already far below the Medicare, for example, reimbursement rate. So there's no degree of freedom there as well. So it's going to be taking the services that we provide and provide them more efficiently. More efficiently, I think the answer is through integrated managed care. I think that's not a bonanza, but at least it'll make some progress forward.
Yes. And we have to really get ready because, as Bob said, Obamacare envisions using Medicaid as a kind of backstop, and some of the and sort of a way of hiding some of the federal costs is to push it down to the state level. So the situation now, if nothing has changed, will become more and more onerous in terms of the amount of money that's going to have to be dealt with. The other kind of double-edged sword here is that the sad thing is when you cut a dollar of out of the state budget, you lose $2 of spending because the federal government matches that. So it's a big change. So saving $1 billion actually costs the providers $2 billion in the state of Illinois.
Let me ask you about the fraud and abuse argument, because I've been talking with some people who'll be running in the primary and expect to be talking to some others. And I think whenever you talk about a problem like this, and you ask people, well, what do you do about the cost of the program? What you're going to hear is that, well, we got a lot of people who are getting covered that shouldn't, either because they shouldn't be getting anything at all, or maybe because they make too much money, and we're not being careful enough in checking who really meets the eligibility standards. And if we just crack down on stuff like that, we'd save a whole lot of money. How much truly fraud and abuse is there? Does anybody know? And if you really could take care of that, well, how helpful would that be?
I'm not sure I have an exact number for you in terms of fraud and abuse. I think it is a problem, but I don't think that if we did away with all of it, we'd solve the financial problems of Medicaid. I mean, there's no doubt that it's an area that's politically attractive to talk about. And there's also no doubt that if we did cut back on the amount of fraud and abuse, it would help. But I don't think it would come anywhere near to solving the Medicaid financial problem that we have.
Unfortunately, getting rid of it is not costless and not easy. There's an analogous sort of situation at the federal level. There's something called the tax gap. And the question is, how much tax would go uncollected? And it's hundreds of billions of dollars every year. So the first thing that a person will do who doesn't want to raise taxes or cut spending is, why don't we go after the people who aren't paying their taxes? Yeah. Well, unfortunately, if it were easy to do, we would have done it. So I think it's the fact that it's there is without question true, but getting at it is more difficult. But I think there are, and in the case of Medicaid, I think there are lots of abuses. But again, they wouldn't make a huge amount of difference in terms of solving the problem. Another example, there was a headline on the front page of the News Gazette a couple days ago about the lieutenant governor was going into a really austerity mode to deal with the budget crisis. And then after you read the article, she was cutting, about $200,000 out of her budget. Which is
$200,000
out of her budget. Well, yeah. That's a lot for the lieutenant governor's office, but $200,000 compared to $33 billion doesn't really get you very far. So you could take all the salary away from the governor and all the general assembly members, get rid of all the stipends, everything of that sort. It might make you feel good for punitive reasons, but it's not going to really solve the problem.
This 9% almost across the board, the governor says he wants everybody to reduce their budgets 9%. Then is that if we could add all of that up, would that amount to much?
Not really, because the problem is the old Willie Sutton question, why do I rob banks? That's where the money is. Well, if you want to save money, you have to go where the money is being spent. It's spent for education, health care, pensions, and prisons, things of that sort. And if that comprises 75 or 80% of the budget, if you want to cut the budget, that's where you have to go. So that's the unfortunate truth of the situation. So I'm not saying that these things shouldn't be done. The austerity is good for has a demonstration effect as well as a real effect, and it's important to do that. But that's not going to solve our problems. And unfortunately, there are lots of wasteful programs, lots of state level kind of earmarks that are totally wasted. But you get rid of all of those, and you still have the same problem. Maybe $100 million less than what we have now.
Yeah. Well, we have a caller here. I'd like to include, maybe just to again tell people who are listening on WILL AM or watching on our website, will.illinois.edu, that you can call in if you have questions, comments for our guests, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. You can send us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Here is a caller in Urbana, right here on line number one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Yes. I think your guests are probably quite right about there being a limited fraud in the Medicare. My point is that whenever a candidate talks about fraud in Medicaid, they always give the impression that this is undeserving recipients. And from what I have seen, the documentation indicates that it's almost entirely among insurance companies and sometimes doctors. And this probably makes it even more difficult to eliminate it, although it should be, if possible.
Yeah, I don't think it's necessarily the insurance companies. It's the providers. There are a number of shady providers around who are generating either actually don't do the work, or they get people who don't need the work done. So I think that's probably the source of the abuse, not particularly the individuals.
Yes, but you never get that impression from listening to the politicians.
Yeah, I agree. It's also the case that there are a small number of people who don't give their correct addresses, or actually if you tried to look at their address, wouldn't live where they say they live. But again, we're talking about a limited number of dollars that would be saved.
Mm-hmm. It certainly won't solve the problems.
Certainly not.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Again, other questions, welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk about the other big problem. Let's talk about pensions. Illinois has the most underfunded pension system in the country, in the United States. Governor has said that pension reform is at the top of his agenda. Everybody agrees something has to be done. The question is what? And this was another one of those cases where the governor stood up and said to the lawmakers, look, this is a really big problem and we have to deal with it. And I'm looking for you to tell me what we should do. And it's another case where we've got a task force that's meeting that's supposed to present some kind of a plan by around the middle of April. So, how do we tackle this problem, particularly for current employees. We sort of, it seems like we have sort of two sets of issues. One is for somebody who might come in, somebody's not working for the state now, but will be coming into the system. That's one thing. But for people who are in there, like us, who have been in there for a long time, what do you do?
Let me talk generally. Bob has actually a particular proposal. Maybe you could talk about that. But I need an obligatory disclaimer. I'm a member of the CSRS board, but nothing I say here represents CSRS. It just represents my own feeling. The problem we talked about with Medicaid was that we're not operating in a vacuum, and in fact, we have to work within the constraints of the federal government rules. That makes it more difficult to do some of these things. There's a similar situation in regard to pension changes. The state of Illinois has a clause in the Constitution called the Non-Impairment Clause, which in some way or another protects the rights of people who have earned pensions from state and local governments. So there's a question yet to be answered legally about whether the Non-Impairment Clause protects rights or benefits earned to date and it could be changed prospectively for people in public employment, or whether once you accept a job in public employment, you're guaranteed the same or better arrangements through the rest of your career. And traditionally, that second interpretation has been the one that most people would believe, but now a lot of people are arguing or asserting that it's only a protection of past benefits, not future benefits. So the point is that the General Assembly could go through all kinds of hard work and pass a bill, and it could very well be declared unconstitutional a few weeks afterwards. So we're operating in a vacuum here. Now, I'll stop at that point and let Bob talk about maybe a particular kind of...
Well, I would say that what Fred said is particularly important because we're not the only state that has a pension problem, and there already have been several major court suits in other states. Most recent one in Arizona that was decided in favor of the people who are current employees, who said that the state, by a non-impairment clause, a similar non-impairment clause to ours, couldn't cut back on benefits for somebody's entire career. I think the pension issues are ones of where I think we need to follow certain principles. One of them is there needs to be fiscal sustainability of the pension systems, which there currently is not. Another way of saying it is the state needs to continue to be committed to paying its share of the normal costs in any given year. There needs to be fairness. That is to say that if there's going to be reform, it's reform that affects employers, employees, and businesses, that are employers as well, both employers and employees, and that we need to be sure that we're committed to actually paying out the benefits. Now, I would also suggest that another major concern on the pension system is to differentiate between the so-called Tier 1 employees, or people like all of us in the room who are current employees, and Tier 2 employees, new employees. And the state, in January of 2011, put in a pension reform proposal that affects new employees that, frankly, makes our state very non-competitive for public employees. And although the governor likes to say, and he did in this speech, that the pension reform proposal for Tier 2 employees is a major step forward, it's a problem, both from a fairness perspective, a fiscal sustainability perspective, and a competitiveness perspective. So that whatever we do, I think, needs to follow those principles. And another way of saying this is I think that pension reform is going to provide pain to everybody. There's going to be a sharing of the pain for everyone.
There are some options that don't become entangled with the non-impairment clause, but they're not very pleasant options. One option is to pass the employer costs away from the state back to the organization. So school districts would now be required to pay the pension would, if that were approved, be required to pay the employer cost, community colleges and universities like the University of Illinois and so on. So that there's nothing wrong with that in terms of constitutional issues, but it's a huge change. What would happen if we decided to make the local school districts and community colleges responsible for the pension payments? Well, they only have so much money, and only two things can happen. Either they have to make major cutbacks in their activities, or they have to come up with new money. The question is, where do schools get their money? It's from the property tax. So I've been in Illinois for 32 years, and the first 30 years, everything was, how do we cut property taxes? Now the state is asking, they may very well ask school districts and community colleges to raise property taxes to pay their pension costs. And one of the continuing concerns about public universities, colleges, universities, is the cost of tuition. Well, if the universities now are asked to pay the pension costs for their employees, where does it come from? Well, they don't have the property tax. They don't have many options, and tuition is their option. So basically, if someone suggests moving the cost back to the employers, they're talking about raising property tax, they're raising tuition. That may be a necessary thing, but it's not a pleasant thing.
And both the speaker and the governor have suggested that only actually a relatively small percentage of pension payments are made to real state employees.
Yes, they say we're not state employees. We work for the university. We don't work for the state.
Right, and so by definition, if you say that university staff and faculty are not state employees, and if you say that school teachers are not as well, that would instantaneously save money for the state, but I think have a substantial negative impact on everybody else.
Yeah. But we need to take a real quick break here and pause for a moment. Then we'll talk some more with our guests, Bob Rich and Fred Gertz, talking about the Illinois state budget. Following a short pause, this is Focus.
On the next Fresh Air, the impact of super PACs on the presidential campaign. We talk with Trevor Potter, a former member of the Federal Elections Committee, who advises Stephen Colbert on his super PAC, and James Bopp, the lawyer who initiated the Citizens United case that ended up in the Supreme Court and opened the door to super PACs. Join us.
This afternoon at 1 and this evening at 7 on AM 580.
WILL programs are made possible by the Center for Advanced Study, whose MillerCom 2012 lecture series presents U.S. Foreign Policy in Africa. Is Obama Policy a Continuation or a Break? With Horace Campbell on Thursday, February 23rd at 4 p.m. in the Knight Auditorium at Spurlock Museum.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us on WILL AM, or if you're watching through our website, that's will.illinois.edu. We're here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week, and we welcome questions and emails. Let me just mention very quickly before we get back to our conversation about the state budget that tomorrow morning in the 10 o'clock hour, we will talk with Wade Davis. He's an explorer in residence at the National Geographic Society. He's also an anthropologist and an ethnobotanist. And we will be talking about a new book that he's authored. The title is Into the Silence, The Great War, Mallory and the Conquest of Everest. And this is all about George Mallory. He was a British mountain climber. Some people would say he was the greatest mountain climber of his day. And it's about the attempt that he made in the early 1920s to climb Mount Everest. He was lost in the attempt, and it's a great story. So we'll talk about that with Wade Davis tomorrow. You can check the schedule by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. You can listen to past programs that way. You can follow us on Twitter at Will Public Media. You can also look for us on Facebook. And this morning, in this hour of the show, we're talking about the state budget, and we have two guests here in the studio with us. Fred Gertz, he's professor of economics, and Bob Rich, he's a professor who has appointments in medicine, law, political science. He is the director of the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the U of I, and Fred is also associated with the Institute. They have a website, by the way, with lots of interesting material there on a variety of policy issues, so you can go there and find out more about the Institute. Questions here are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. To continue with the pension thing for a little bit, do you think sooner or later, do you think, is the Illinois Supreme Court going to have to make a ruling on what that clause that Fred was talking about actually means?
They don't provide advisory opinions, so the only way to get an opinion is to pass a potential impairment and have someone tested in court.
So someone's got to do it, and then someone's got to challenge
the other
it.
Option.
I think it's inevitable, however, David.
But you
as soon as the legislature passes a bill, there will be a suit, almost for sure.
The other option, which again I'm not recommending, but would be to have a constitutional amendment, which would clarify the non-impairment clause, saying it either you could have it either way. It applies to someone once they accept employment through their whole career, or it only goes to the current date, and future changes are possible. And you could have either amendment, but that would actually clarify things. It wouldn't necessitate a court test, but no one's proposing that right now.
So we have a couple of different levels that we talk about. We have one level we talk about, well, what do you do with those people who have been in the system for a very long time? And then there's the issue of people who are younger and who have not been working for the state for that long, and then people who might be coming in, you know, next week or next year. Now, you and I think some of your colleagues at the Institute have been thinking about this and have made some proposals for a new kind of system that I think would actually maybe combine some elements of this multi-tiered choice system that they're talking about giving people. What is it that you're suggesting?
Basically what we've said, following the principles of sustainability and, if you will, spreading the pain, the fairness principle, is we've suggested that that the university as an employer needs to take over a percentage of the costs. So we said 3 to 4 percent of the 8 percent, that we have a what's called a stacked system, a defined benefit on top, and on top of which you'd have a defined contribution. So the defined benefit would be guaranteed for everyone who is vested in the system. And that cost would be shared by the university, the state, and you and I as employees. And then you could have a defined contribution system, so a self-managed plan or a 401k type of plan that for current employees would be voluntary. So as a current employee, you could stay with the system that you currently have, pay a bit more for it, or you could switch over to the new system, and the defined benefit part would be at the level of Social Security. So it would be the figure of maximum $106,900, and then the rest of your pension could be a defined contribution kind of system. That's the heart of it, is shared costs among employers, employees, and the state, and what we're calling the stacked system.
This is kind of a compromise, because the options so far are basically to do nothing and leave the current system in place, which turned out to be very expensive. And the other is a kind of punitive response on the part of the state. And Bob mentioned the pension reform for new employees. We now have a pension system for new employees that in some ways is inferior to Social Security. And state employees are not, for the most part, members of Social Security. So what Bob and Jeff Brown are suggesting is a kind of hybrid system where there would be a undergirding of a defined benefit plan similar to but not the same as Social Security, and then on top of that would be the defined contribution where people would have to pay more of their own costs. One of the continuing criticisms of the state pension system, especially CSRS, is that a lot of people are receiving relatively high benefits, and there are two reasons for that. One is that we don't have Social Security, so our pension system includes both a traditional private system and also a substitute for Social Security. The other is that, like it or not, there are a lot of highly paid employees at the university, administrators and medical professors, things of that sort. And if you have a high income, that usually results in a fairly high pension as well.
What do you think that it would be the likelihood that at some point the state of Illinois would start to tax the benefit?
Well, that's a issue that's totally open. There's not, as far as I understand it, there are no impediments for doing that.
There's nothing preventing the state from doing it.
But politically, it's a very dangerous thing. The thing that I don't think most people realize when we talk about taxing pension benefits, I think it would be illegal, unconstitutional for the state to tax the benefits of public employees. What they'd have to do would be to tax all pension benefits, including 401ks, all the other things. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. politically, that's a very major sort of step, and I don't think anyone wants to take that step. And also, it's become a more dramatic step because up until last year, taxing benefits meant 3% tax. Now taxing benefits means a 5% tax. So that would not be a easy step to take politically, but certainly on the table. Another thing that is there that could be done, there's no constitutional guarantee of post-retirement non-pension benefits. So the state could, if they chose, increase the contribution rate for medical care. They could mm-hmm. increase it for working state employees as well. So those are not off the table, but the governor hasn't really emphasized those very strongly.
Mm-hmm. Other possibilities are increasing the retirement age. In other words, the point at which you can qualify for a pension, you could increase that age. You could also limit the amount of increase each year that's guaranteed for your pension, although that would be a constitutional issue in as part of the non-impairment
in tax policy, often we think about how about the current tax? How about a new tax? But one of the major issues in regard to changing taxes is transitioning from one system to another. Well, the same thing is true here. If you go from the current system to a new system, how do you transition? So, for example, if you have a 60-year retirement age under the old system and a 67-year under the new system, you can't retire at two different times. So the question, how would you phase that in? And mm-hmm. no one really knows the answer to those transitional issues.
Let's take another caller here. We got about 5-6 minutes left. We have a couple of callers, in fact, so we'll try to get them both. And one is in Urbana, one is in Champaign. So we'll start first with Urbana and line one. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have a question. If they were to change the definition of who is a state employee from the standpoint of the university and teachers' unions, teachers not being covered, you know, for their benefits and having to be paid by the institution, how does that affect the medical insurance benefits?
It doesn't directly, but it certainly. School employees who are retired are covered under medical care, but for university people who we used to call state employees, they're covered under the state plan. So that could be changed, but it's not part of the same question. It's sort of a separate issue. But I think
even though it's a self-funded plan paid by the state, it does not affect it. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it doesn't affect it directly, but clearly the same motives that might cause the change in the pension system might also cause a change in the health care benefits. So it's not the same issue, but it's certainly related in terms of what the state might do.
And there's no doubt that health insurance premium increases are a major part of the health care delivery problem in the state as well. And so my own view is that at some point there are going to be at least proposed changes
and the
along the line of limiting the amount of health insurance coverage or making pensioners and employees more generally pay a lot more for their health insurance coverage.
Yeah, the major cost to the state is not the 75-year-old retiree. The major cost is the early retiree. The period from retirement until Medicare eligibility is hugely expensive for the state. Once someone becomes Medicare eligible, then most of the payments are by federal government. So the early retiree issue, raising the retirement age, actually saves you money in terms of pensions, but it also saves money in terms of the health care costs for retirees.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. On to Champaign. This is another person on line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I listened in intently thinking that someone would make a comparison to our situation to the Greek situation, but nobody has. So I guess I'd have to call in and make it. And the obvious question is why doesn't anyone point to the federal government in the same way that Greece has a bailout and austerity program directed toward them. Obama could do the same thing to the Illinois, and it's a kind of a obvious solution because they're the only ones with the capability to create money out of thin air. And I'll hang up and listen to your answer.
Obviously, the federal government has its own problems, and they're not eager to take on the problems of the state of Illinois and other states. And I have a quote that I use sometimes. There's a quotation from Hemingway from The Sun Also Rises. Two people were talking to one another, and one guy who appeared to have been very wealthy had gone bankrupt, and his friend asked him, "How did you go bankrupt?" And his answer was, "Slowly at first, gradually at first, and then suddenly." Well, unfortunately, we're still in the gradual stage now, but if you don't make some adjustments during that gradual stage, you get to the sudden stage, and that applies both to the state of Illinois and to the United States.
We are here, and we'll be here for about another 5-6 minutes with Fred Gertz and Bob Richard talking about the Illinois state budget. You have questions, comments, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. I wanted to ask, and admittedly, this is not something that would really solve all our problems, but I wanted to bring up the subject of gambling. One of the issues that was debated in Springfield last year was the expansion of gambling, and the city of Chicago wants to have a casino, and I think Danville would like to have a casino. And the governor had some concerns about gambling regulations, and basically he quashed that plan. And I don't know whether that's likely to come back. But I did actually have an email from somebody who was interested in the recent Justice Department ruling that apparently reinterpreted the Wire Act such that online gambling was no longer considered illegal. Maybe we can fold that into a question of whether in Springfield they're going to come back to this issue, and whether that gives you any possibility, I suppose, for expanding your customer base if you can have people gambling online. You set up an Illinois casino, I guess anybody anywhere could spend their money.
Well, but we could also spend our money other places, so give and take. The problem with the expansion of gambling is that whether you like it or don't like it, it doesn't raise enough money to change the equation very much. If there's any question that I hear almost certainty anytime I talk to people is how come the lottery, which went into place several decades ago, didn't solve our education problem? Well, the problem is that we collect $600 million from the lottery and we spend multi-billion dollars for education, and it simply wasn't large enough. So the assertion is the state somehow misappropriated that money and spent it for other purposes, which they may well have done, but it's not going to solve our problems. And in addition to the size, there's also kind of the glacial pace of getting things done. I'm not sure how the 10th casino license, how long that's been in play now, but it's taken 5 or 10 years to transition from a license up in northwestern Illinois to another one, and we're still not getting the revenues yet, and it's still on the books sometime, somewhere, someplace we're going to get money from that 10th casino. So it's very difficult to get that. The other issue with gambling is that this may not sit well with Governor Eggert, but we seem to have an implicit obligation to support the racetracks if we want to raise more money. So if we want to raise money from casinos or whatever it is, a certain amount of that money has to go to the racetracks to keep them happy, and that seems to be insane given our fiscal situation.
Yeah. But the other part of your question is it going to come up again in this session of the General Assembly? I think the answer is most likely yes. Mm. I think that the proponents of gambling, increasing gambling, will bring up the issue again, and it has this popular fallacy of saying, gee, that's an attractive way to raise more money, which it, as Fred indicated, really won't.
Yeah, that and the gasoline tax, not the gasoline tax, not the wrong word, the cigarette tax, those are two winners. Anytime you have a problem, raise the cigarette tax or increase gambling, right. And unfortunately it just doesn't generate the money.
Yeah. We just have a couple of minutes left, and I guess I find myself coming back to, one thing I come back to is the problem of the structural deficit, which I think doesn't quite get as much attention as it should, because we talk about what's happening now, we talk about fiscal 13, but we have this problem, and you can clearly see it easily and best on a graph where you graph out over time your projections for revenue and your projections for spending. And it's real clear that if you track that out, those two lines, they just keep spreading further and further out into the future. Now, though, having said that, I guess one of the things that I wanted to ask Fred, and you've spent a lot of time tracking the state economy, is whether we can expect any time in the near future enough improvement in the economy so that that is going to at least bring in a little bit more revenue. So, I mean, is there any reason to be optimistic about some recovery, and then whether that would help us out or not?
Now, I am somewhat optimistic about recovery, and that actually is built into the revenues next year. So that has not escaped the notice of the people in Springfield. But it's not modest. It's $700 million. That's a huge amount of money, but it's modest compared to our problem. So even with normal growth, we still have this problem. The tax increase sort of didn't change the slopes of the graph, but it changed where they start. Prior to the tax increase, we had a $6 or $7 billion current deficit, and in addition to that, it got bigger and bigger and bigger into the future. The tax increase, to a large extent, closed the current deficit, but the lines that you talked about still diverge. The expected growth in revenue is not as fast as the expected growth in spending. That's why we have to make some of these pension and Medicaid changes.
Yeah. At this point, I expect we'll be seeing you again. We'll I'm sure have other opportunities to talk. But now, at this point, with about a minute or so here left, you know, what would you like to leave with folks? What thought would you like to leave with folks?
This is a long-term problem that's going to require long-term solutions. And any notion that we can quickly address the overall fiscal problem or the specific ones is illusory. So I'd like to say, we need fiscal discipline. We need to raise some additional revenue, and we need to pay off the debt. But that's going to take it took a long time to get there. It's going to take a long time to solve it.
Yeah. Well, this may be an unfortunate choice of analogies. It's the basketball analogy. But John Wooden, the most successful college basketball coach in history, had a saying that if you get 10 points behind, don't try to catch up instantaneously. Just start playing better and cut down the deficit over a period of time. I think the same thing applies here. There's no way we can solve our problems in this fiscal year and next fiscal year. But as Bob said, we have to get started and impart some discipline into the process and try to get things right over a period of several years.
Well, there, for the moment, we'll leave it with our thanks to Fred Kurtz and Bob Rich for being here. You can check up on what's happening at the Institute, the place where they work. If you go to their website, that's the Institute of Government and Public Affairs, based at the University of Illinois. You can take a look at the brand new issue of the Illinois Report for 2012, which indeed addresses budget concerns as well as a lot of other things. Thank you both very much.
Thank you. Here.